The one thing that we seem to be in short supply of now is basic human manners. And I think manners are very important. I didn't think that way when I was a kid. But now I think basic human manners are really important for getting along with other people, for creating a comfortable society where people are comfortable with each other, where people aren't afraid. And I think being polite to other people is a sign of our respect for them. And respect for other living beings is something that's quite important. Whether we agree with people or don't agree with people, it's important to respect them as living beings who want happiness, who don't want suffering, and to talk to them politely. So it isn't that we should just be nice and be polite to the people that we like that agree with us and disrespect everybody else. We'll never get anywhere in our spiritual practice if we hold that kind of thought. But rather to really respect everybody, to consider the effect of our behavior on them, and because of that, to just be polite, yeah? Be easy to get along with, just in, you know, regular human interactions that we have with friends and strangers and even people we don't like. Because it's going to be very difficult to become a Buddha if we're rude and lack basic basic respect for other living beings. So even though it seems like something obvious, it's not well taken care of in today's society. So let's generate that motivation to treat others with respect and use that respect as the basis for developing love, compassion, the altruistic intention of bodhicitta. And then, of course, putting our energy into accomplishing the path, so we could be of great benefit to other living beings. So take a moment and cultivate that motivation. So at the risk of sounding like your mother when you were 4 years old, this is really a conclusion that I've come to from, you know, being with a lot of people in a lot of situations and also observing how things are done in society now. And, you know, if we talk about bodhicitta and altruism for all living beings, but we can't even talk to other people in a nice tone of voice and say please and thank you, then, you know, how are we going to get to these higher levels of mind? You know, it's not going to happen. And I realized by watching the news, I was really shocked, you know, at the way some people talk to other people. And I thought, you know, I mean, I was so shocked that I thought, if I were in that situation, I would probably not know what to say because I'm so unaccustomed to people talking like that. Yeah, because I was raised, you know, you try and be nice. Yeah. And I'm realizing, you know, when we let that quality degenerate in society and we feel we can just talk in any old way and say whatever we want and insult people and criticize them and humiliate them just to show that we're powerful or whatever it is, yeah, then really we're degenerating. Yeah, we're degenerating as a society and as individuals, you know, if we allow ourselves to treat others like that. Okay, so yeah, basic manners, you know, like our parents taught us when we were 4 and 5 years old, they're really important. Yeah, because our actions influence others. Yeah, and that's one of the things that I really see in working with inmates is one of the big aha things they have is when it's like, oh, my behavior influenced other people. Yeah? And, 'cause sometimes, I mean, it's not just the incarcerated people, it's all of us, we don't realize or we don't think about how our behavior influences other people. We just do what we want and expect other people to live with it. And to really see the incarcerated people, when they realize that, that something really begins to change, really begins to change in them. And I think for all of us, yeah, when we come out of our own self-centered little cocoon enough to realize that what we say and do, influences other people, can be the source of pleasure, can be the source of pain, can be the source of inspiration, can be the source of discouragement. And then tap in here and, you know, what kind of life do we want to live? I think most of us want to live a life where we can, you know, increase the happiness of those around us, whether we know them or don't know them. So this is all basic elementary stuff, but it's really important on the path to awakening. Yeah, because if we don't have this, then, you know, what are we doing in our meditations about the disadvantages of self-centeredness and the benefits of cherishing others and the kindness of others and so on, you know? Something's not clicking. Okay, so for the people who are online, yeah, we've been having a course the last week going through the foundation of Buddhist practice, and I had intended to reach a good stopping point this morning, but I didn't succeed in doing that. Surprise. So I thought that this evening I would continue teaching a little bit from and reading from the foundation of Buddhist practice, hopefully to reach a good stopping point. And the topic that we're on, I think, will be helpful for people even they haven't been at the whole course and you're just tuning in now. Okay? And if you're unhappy, well, I'm talking about the 8 virtuous mental factors and the 6 root afflictions. So then you can check up whether you have the virtuous mental factors or root afflictions arising. Okay, so this morning we started talking about the virtuous mental factors. We talked about faith or confidence. We talked about integrity that avoids negative actions out of self-respect and a sense of the kind of person we want to be. We talked about consideration of others, helps us to refrain from negative actions because we care about the effect of our behavior on others. And then the fourth one we talked about this morning was non-attachment, which is not just the opposite of attachment or the lack of attachment, but it's a mind that's completely the opposite of attachment. So it's a mind that, of generosity, of balance, of, you know, seeing things in a realistic fashion without exaggeration. Then the next one, number 5, is non-hatred. So we had non-attachment, non-hatred. Okay, so non-hatred, too, is not just the lack of hatred and anger. It's the opposite of animosity. So it's love and benevolence, not just the absence of anger and ill will. Okay. When referring to someone who harms us, the harm itself or the cause of the harm, it has the characteristic of love and directly overcomes anger and hatred. It is the basis for the prevention of hostility and the increase of love, benevolence, forgiveness, and fortitude. And seeing that the day after tomorrow is Veterans Day, or rather Armistice Day, it's the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. And World War I was devastating. You know, they said it was the war to end all wars, but we kept having wars after it. But it was one of the most horrible wars. Yeah. And so this mental factor of non-hatred, yeah, is very important to prevent wars like that. Yeah. Without it, then, you know, we get irritated, we get annoyed, that builds up, we hold grudges, we get angry, we hate other people, we get outraged and enraged and belligerent and spiteful and, you know, we have all sorts of words to indicate that kind of mental factors, you know, those kind of mental factors. But non-hatred is the opposite of all of that. So it's love, and love in a Buddhist sense is just wanting others to have happiness and its causes. Yeah? In the situation of war, you want others to have suffering and its causes. And they have suffering and its causes, and so do you. Yeah? When we're able to have love and benevolence and to wish others well, to forgive them, to take the time to try and communicate with them properly, yeah, then we can avoid so much pain in our planet. So we need to do this on a personal level, on a group level, on an international level. But it has to start with us on the personal level. Because if we don't build a new kind of mental habit in ourselves of how to deal with harm, then, you know, we certainly aren't, as the member of a group, going to have that attitude. Okay, so it has to start with our internal transformation here. And so also including forgiveness in this and remembering that forgiveness doesn't mean saying what the other person did was okay. It just means saying, I'm going to not hold a grudge. Yeah, I'm tired of being angry. I'm tired of hating. Hating does not get me anywhere. Okay. Then number six is non-confusion. So these are the three nons: non-attachment, non-hatred, non-confusion. So it is the opposite of confusion, not just the lack of it. Okay, so arising from an inborn disposition and nurtured by study, reflection, and meditation, non-confusion acts as a remedy for confusion and ignorance and accompanies the firm wisdom that thoroughly analyzes the nature and specific characteristics of an object. It prevents confusion, increases the four types of wisdom, and helps to actualize constructive qualities. Okay, so this is a good one to cultivate. Yeah, and we cultivate it by study, reflection, and meditation, and then applying it, you know. So study all the different Dharma topics, especially studying karma, yeah. If we have a good understanding of karma, that's very helpful for getting our life tuned up and in line. Yeah, because if we have an understanding of karma, then we look for ways to meet our needs that are non-harmful to others. Okay. And so with non-confusion, we're developing wisdom. We're seeing things in a much clearer way. So it's not just, you know, not getting confused. It doesn't mean you'll never get confused when you drive again and take a wrong turn. It's that, not that kind of non-confusion. It's the kind of non-confusion about what is important to do in life and what we should abandon doing. It's the absence, the opposite of confusion about how things exist. So really knowing how they exist on an ultimate level and on a conventional level. Okay, then the seventh virtuous mental factor is joyous effort. And it counteracts laziness and joyfully engages in constructive actions. It acts to generate constructive qualities that have not been generated and to bring those that have to completion. Okay, so laziness from a Buddhist perspective isn't just lying around, but it's keeping ourselves very busy doing worldly activities so that we don't engage in any Dharma practice. And also being discouraged is laziness. So if you get discouraged or depressed, that's seen as laziness in a Buddhist sense. Why? Because it keeps us from doing anything virtuous. You know, we just kind of, oh, I'm discouraged. You know? So joyous effort is the opposite of that. You know, joyous effort really sees the potential that we have as human beings. It appreciates our precious human life. It appreciates the fact that we're interested in the Dharma. Yeah, I mean, respecting our own internal spiritual yearning is very important. Yeah, and so respecting that, treasuring that, living according to that, you know, then we appreciate things and we put energy into doing what is meaningful and important in our life instead of just kind of dragging around, you know. Okay, then number eight is pliancy. So this is a mental factor. When we studied serenity, the mental factors that you want that are the antidotes to some of the faults that prevent us from having concentration. So pliancy is a big one that remedies a lot of those faults. So it enables the mind to apply itself to a constructive object in whatever manner it wishes and dissipates any mental or physical tightness or rigidity. Okay, so this pliancy is something cultivated as we're developing concentration in our meditative practice, and it is the one that banishes, a lot of the resistance, a lot of the tightness, the rigidity, the, you sit down to meditate and your mind's cranky and uncooperative and, stuck in its own ways, and it, I don't want to meditate, make me, like a three-year-old. Pliancy is the one that remedies that. Not only the mental discomfort, but also the physical discomfort. And so when, you're able to develop deep concentration, then also the body feels very light, very invigorated. They say you feel like you could ride on your own shoulders. I'm not quite sure, but you get the idea that, it's not like, oh God, okay. So that's pliancy. Then number 9 is conscientiousness. So conscientiousness values the accumulation of virtue and guards the mind against that which gives rise to afflictions. So it brings to fulfillment and maintains all that is good, protects the mind from pollution, and is the root for attaining all the grounds and paths. Okay, so conscientiousness is quite important, and it's a mind that values accumulating virtue and opposing the afflictions. Yeah, so a mind that just, it's like having our head on straight. Yeah, we're conscientious. We our values and principles are in order. Okay, we know what we believe in. We're trying to live according to them. We're not sloppy, okay, in a way that just lets all the, afflictions rise up and control our mind. Okay, so conscientiousness, it's even in ordinary language, ordinary life, it's somebody who's conscientious is somebody we trust, isn't it? Don't you trust people who are conscientious? Because you know they'll do what they say, or if they can't, they'll let you know. They're responsible. They can make good decisions. Okay? So, conscientiousness. Yeah. It's the 9th virtuous mental factor. Mm-hmm. So with all of these, I can't. Well, I can assign the people who are living here homework. Yeah. So, So your conversation for tomorrow's breakfast is talk about these 11 virtuous mental factors and how they play a role in your life and your ideas for how to develop them and increase them in your life. Like, how can you learn to be more conscientious? How can you develop your joyous effort? Yeah. How can you, cultivate non-attachment? Okay? So talk about this because it's quite important for what we're doing. Okay, then the 10th one is non-harmfulness or non-cruelty. And so this one is compassion. So non-hatred was love. Non-harmfulness is compassion. It's just a way of saying it so that it's, instead of saying the positive thing, it's saying it's the opposite of some negative attribute. So non-harmfulness is ahimsa, the non-violence that Gandhiji talks so much about. Okay, so lacking any intention to cause harm It wishes all sentient beings to be free from suffering. It prevents disrespecting or harming others and increases the wish to benefit and bring them happiness. So, this is a mental factor that applies to the motivation, yeah, of being kind and respectful to other living beings, you know, rather than to be harmful, to be cruel, to take delight at the power we have to embarrass somebody or put them down or put them in their place and show them that we're better and we're more powerful or we're more intelligent or whatever it is. So non-harmfulness is the total opposite of that. Yeah, it's a mind of compassion that doesn't want to harm to others and wants whatever suffering others have to be alleviated. Okay, very important one. And it's, you know, it says here, it prevents disrespecting or harming others and increases the wish to benefit and bring them happiness. Yeah, so if we want to really change our mind that takes our irritation out on other people, do you do that? When you're irritated, do you take it out on other people? I bet you remember more times when other people take it out on you than when you've taken it out on them. Yeah, we're like that, aren't we? But we do take our irritation out on other people. Yeah. And sometimes we take out more than irritation, you know. We take out frustration, hatred, you know, confusion. I mean, look at the guy at, you know, the most recent mass shooting in Thousand Oaks, California, you know, going into a bar and, you know, dancing place where all sorts of college students and young people and really, and some of the people who escaped the slaughter in Vegas were in that hall on, it was on Wednesday night. So twice some of the people have escaped during mass shootings. Somebody who lived through Vegas got killed in this one. Yeah, 12 people were murdered, 22 injured. Yeah, or it might have been 13, actually. So, so non-harmfulness, this is the mental factor that prevents that kind of stuff. Okay, the wish not to cause harm to anybody. So it's quite sad because it was done by a former Marine. And it was making me remember, remember a couple of years ago when there was another mass shooting in a church in Texas? That guy had also been in the military. Yeah, so I think we also have to ask ourselves, are we taking care of veterans properly? Yeah. And this one isn't even 2 weeks after the killing at the synagogue. Yeah, not even 2 weeks. It's like we're having one mass murder more frequently than before. It's speeding up. Something's quite wrong, isn't it? There was one mother, her son was killed, and she said, I don't want prayers. I don't want thoughts. I want gun control. Yeah. And there was also the video of one father. Oh, my goodness. His son was killed in it. And this father was just, I mean, he was... Yeah, I mean, his pain was just indescribable, and it came out through how he spoke. Okay, so non-harmfulness, compassion, important. Okay. And it's helpful so that we don't think we're superior to people who do those kind of actions, to remember that if we were put in situations that those people have lived through, we may act in the same way. Yeah. So to never be arrogant and think, oh, I'm better than them. Yeah, because until we get rid of our afflictions, we're all susceptible. Okay, then equanimity. Upekkha. That's the Pali, yeah? Our kitty, upekkha. Well, actually, the non-harmfulness is compassion. That's karuna. The non-hatred is love. That's maitri. Okay, so we're missing joy, yeah, for mudita. Maybe we can get her in with joyous effort. Yeah. Okay, so equanimity does not allow the mind to be greatly affected by restlessness and laxity without having to exert great effort to prevent them. It is important for the development of serenity. It enables the mind to settle and remain on a virtuous object. This equanimity differs from the equanimity of the four immeasurables and the equanimity that is a neutral feeling. Okay, so there's different kinds of equanimity. Yeah, the equanimity of the four immeasurables wishes for other sentient beings to be free of attachment and anger and bias. Okay. The equanimity that is a neutral feeling belongs in the feeling aggregate. It's the neutral feeling in the feeling aggregate. This equanimity that is a virtuous mental factor is one that is generated as we're cultivating serenity and afterwards in practicing the dhyanas, the higher types of concentration. And it doesn't allow the mind to be greatly affected by laxity and restlessness. So in generating serenity, laxity and restlessness are two of the big problems, okay? Laxity is a mind that is unclear about the object of meditation, even to the point of being spaced out about it. And if we don't take care of the laxity, it becomes, the gross form of laxity becomes lethargy, sloth, even falling asleep. And then restlessness is the other one. And restlessness is when your mind is about to go off to an object of attachment. Okay? It's a restless mind that's like, well, you know how it is when you have a restless mind. Yeah. So equanimity is what calms that kind of restlessness and laxity and doesn't allow them to take over the mind. Okay, so those are the 11 virtuous mental factors. So they're important to learn and reflect on and identify in our own experience so that we can learn to tell the difference between having a virtuous mind and a non-virtuous mind. Because if we can't tell the difference between when our mind is virtuous and when it's not, then certainly we won't be able to tell the difference between when we're creating constructive karma and when we're creating destructive karma. Okay? So good to contemplate these. Think how to enrich them, enhance them in your own mind and not let them slide and get destroyed. Okay, now we're going to move into the six root afflictions. So these we are much more familiar with. Okay. So these six are called root afflictions because they are primary causes of cyclic existence, and they are the root or cause of the auxiliary afflictions. Okay, so this is why they're called root. They're the primary cause of cyclic existence, and they're the root of all the other secondary or auxiliary afflictions. Okay, they're called afflictions because they afflict our mind. They make our mind unhappy. They make our mind unrealistic. Okay, they disturb our mental peace. So the six root are the basis for all distorted conceptions and emotional conflict. Sometimes the last root affliction, afflictive views, is subdivided into five, so that then we have 10 afflictions. 10 root afflictions, I should say. Yeah. So first one, attachment. Yeah, so attachment arises based on projecting or exaggerating the attractiveness of an object within cyclic existence. So not the Dharma, you know, that kind of stuff, but something within cyclic existence, people, things, ideas, places, and so forth. It wishes for and takes a strong interest in and clings to that object. Okay? So the way attachment arises is that, you know, we see an object, and then there's this other mental factor called distorted attention or distorted conception, where we project things on the object that it doesn't have. So in the case of attachment, we project wonderful things. You know, if I only had this, I will be happy. If this person praises me, then I'm worthwhile. If, you know, I can be with this person, then I'll always feel secure. All this kind of stuff, okay? So it's based on exaggeration, and then we get interested in the object, and then what I call the bubblegum mind comes. You know, bubblegum. Yeah, it pops in your face and it sticks everywhere. You step on bubble gum, you're sticky. Yeah. So this is what attachment is like. It's a sticky mind. It's like, you know, I gotta have this. I gotta be with this. I can't separate from it. Yeah. So it sticks to people. It sticks to possessions, to ideas, to reputation, to praise, to money, to places that we like, you know, anything around us we can develop attachment for. Given the right circumstances, we will develop attachment to anything. Okay? And I'll give you an example from my life. People in some of the comments they wrote about the retreat said they love my when I speak personally, my example. So now I'm going to give you an example. Okay. When I lived in India in the, when was this? The late 70s, middle and late 70s. So I was quite poor. And toilet paper in India was quite expensive. Yeah. So toilet paper isn't something you ever think you could become attached to. But when you don't have much money and toilet paper is expensive, you become very attached to your toilet paper. And I rationed it, yeah, because I didn't have much money, and if it ran out, I was stuck. Okay? So that's what I mean by, given the right situation, we can become attached to anything. Yeah? And exaggerate the importance of something, crave it, want it. Okay, so true confession. Yeah? I bet you never thought of being attached to toilet paper. When in India, too, you know what you're really attached to. Not so much now because India has modernized, but before, wow, heaven was a hot shower. Wow. You know, when you could take a hot shower, because there were very few hot showers. So you could settle for a bucket bath, you know, with a bucket and your dipper. Okay. But those were hard to come by too. Hot water was really difficult to get. Yeah. So, you know, here I don't think people are so attached to hot showers. Although sometimes you can really crave one here too. But when you were there, like a few decades ago, wow, craving for hot showers. Sounds so stupid, but when we crave something, what we do to get what we want, yeah, we're ruthless. When we want something, we are ruthless. Okay, second root affliction, anger. Okay, arises based on projecting or exaggerating the unattractive qualities of a person or object. It agitates the mind through being unable to bear or through wanting to harm that object or person. It arises in reference to somebody who harms us, the suffering itself, or the cause of the harm. Okay? So just like attachment, anger is based on exaggeration, except anger, the basis that is behind anger is the exaggeration or the projection of negative qualities of someone or something. Okay? So the mind gets agitated when we're angry. Yeah, you're certainly not peaceful and calm and relaxed, are you? You know, we're agitated. And we're unable to bear the situation. Totally unable to bear. This is not permissible according to my rules of the universe. It must stop immediately. Okay? And so from there comes the wish to harm, either physically or verbally. Yeah. One way it isn't only acting aggressive that is a result of anger, but acting extremely passive can also be a result of anger. Okay? We are so angry that we just leave the situation, refuse to talk, refuse to engage. Yeah? Do you ever get like that? Yeah, it's like, I'm out of here, and I don't care if you suffer because of it. I am not talking to you. Forget it. Okay? So it can lead, you know, anger gets expressed in many different ways. Yeah, we can harm somebody by exploding at them. We can harm somebody by withdrawing, can't we? Yeah. Okay, so that's the second one. Third one, arrogance. Yeah, sometimes it's translated as pride, but pride in English can have a double meaning. You know, when you really rejoice at what somebody did, we often say, I'm really proud of you. Yeah? So that's why I hesitate to use the word pride here, because it can also have a very good meaning. It can mean rejoicing, yeah? So arrogance, I don't think, has a good meaning. Yeah, we can't find one. Sometimes it's conceit, okay? But I think arrogance, well, arrogance is good for the general category. There's different types of arrogance. There's one type that is called the conceit of I. And I really, I'm so glad the Buddha pointed that one out. That one is just the conceit of I. I am here. I exist. I. You know, it's a conceit, isn't it? Yeah. So other types of arrogance, well, let me read the description here, is based on the view of a personal identity that apprehends an inherently existent I or mind. It strongly grasps an inflated or superior image of ourselves, although sometimes it can grasp a deflated image. Usually it grasps the inflated one. So we may compare ourselves with somebody. We are better. You poor slob. We compete with somebody, but we're still better. We're not as good as somebody, but we find a way to make ourselves better. We have bad ethical conduct. We're very proud of it. I put that person in their place, you know. And sometimes we're proud because we know somebody who is very well known or, you know, well respected. So I am a disciple of so-and-so. I am a friend of so-and-so. I know all these important people. I'm nobody, but I know all these important people. Yeah, so that makes me special somehow. Or it's the one of I'm worse than everybody else. You know, I'm really, you know, I compare myself to everybody else. Nobody is as messed up as me. I take the cake. Yeah, so that's a form of arrogance too. It inflates the self. Fourth one, ignorance, is a state of unknowing brought about by the mind being unclear about the nature of things, such as the four truths of the Aryas, karma and its results, and the three jewels. So this definition is held in common by all Buddhist tenet systems, although each system has its own unique way of defining ignorance. And this will be discussed in depth later in Volume 3, which is coming out in January. As I've reminded you almost every day during the course, so you don't forget. Okay. So ignorance, according to the Prasangika, is grasping at inherent existence. It's not just a state of unknowing that doesn't know how things exist. It's a mind that apprehends things as existing in the exact opposite way from how they actually exist. So things are dependent. They depend on other factors. But we apprehend things as being independent, having their own self-nature, yeah, something inside them that makes them what they are, independent of everything else. So this ignorance is the big troublemaker. Then fifth one, deluded doubt, is indecisive wavering that tends toward an incorrect conclusion about important points such as karma and its results, the four truths and the three jewels. Okay, so it's not just doubt about, you know, should I bet on this horse or that horse? Okay, it's doubt about something important, you know, that has to do with your liberation. And it's inclined towards the wrong conclusion. Okay, then the sixth one is afflictive views. So they are either an active, an afflictive intelligence, a corrupt understanding, or they are either an afflictive intelligence that regards the aggregates as being inherently I or mine, or, in direct dependence on such a view, an afflictive intelligence that further develops, develops further mistaken conceptions. Okay, so it's called an afflictive intelligence, yeah, but it also includes wrong views. So what kind of, why is it called the type of intelligence? It's called intelligence, even though it is not intelligence. It's called intelligence because it involves an analytical process. But it is corrupt because it doesn't analyze things in the right way. It comes to all the wrong conclusions. So it isn't a real intelligence, even though it has that name. Yeah, when you go into further study in Buddhism, you find lots of things that are called something but aren't that. So you just have to get used to it. Okay. So this in particular, yeah, it either regards the aggregates, the body and mind, as being inherently I or mine, or depending on that view, it creates all sorts of other wrong conceptions. Mm-hmm. So these wrong conceptions are big problems for us. Yeah, and like I said, they're not just, you know, the wrong conception that you should bake the cake at 500 degrees instead of 350, you know. It's wrong conceptions about things that are really important, like how things exist, you know. And do our actions have an ethical dimension? Do they lead to results? Yeah. You know, we talk about Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Do they exist, or are they make-believe? So, these afflictive views hold the opposite of how things actually are. So, the first one of them is called the view of a personal identity. So, this is an afflictive intelligence that, when referring to the conventional I or mine, grasps it to be either inherently I or mine. It is called intelligence in the sense that it analyzes something. It is the root of samsara and acts as the basis for all afflictions, together with ignorance. Those two are really good buddies. Okay, so this view of a personal identity, it views the conventionally existent self and then thinks that self exists from its own side, under its own power, is, a real I or a real mine, a real owner, the one that considers things mine. Okay? So when they say I or mine, I is like the agent who does something. Mine is the one to whom things belong. Yeah. So our sense of mine is also very important, isn't it? Yeah, this is mine, and this is mine, and this is mine. And yeah. As soon as we label something mine, have you noticed how it completely changes meaning? Yeah. When the car's on the showroom floor and gets dented, no problem. As soon as I label that car mine, if it gets dented, big problem. Okay? All that's changed is the designation, the label on it. Still the same car. But when we label something mine, oh boy. Yeah. My family, my parents, my children, my reputation, my praise, my love, my appreciation. Okay. My book, my money, My room, my boots. Okay. Eating bowl. Okay, my pen. As soon as we label anything mine, boy. Yeah. So that's the view of the extremes. The second afflictive view is the view of extremes. So it also is an afflictive intelligence that when referring to the I or mine grasp by the view of a personal identity, regards them in an absolutist or nihilistic fashion. So it prevents us from finding the view of the middle way free of extremes. Okay, so first you have the view of a personal identity. There's a real me and a real mine. So this intelligence looks at that, okay, and then at the I, the inherently existent I and inherently existent mind, which do not exist at all, okay, and then regards them either in an absolutist way or nihilistic way. Absolutist way is, yes, they really are inherently existent. I'm sure of it. Nihilistic way is, if they don't inherently exist, then they don't exist at all. Okay, so we come across this a lot when we study emptiness, you know, not falling into the two extremes of considering the I and mine inherently existent or totally non-existent. Okay, the third one, the view holding wrong views as supreme, is an afflictive intelligence that regards the other afflictive views as the best views. It increases our attachment to other afflictive views. So this one looks at all the other kind of confused views we have and says, these are the best views you can possibly have. Yes, the I is inherently existent. Yeah? You know, yes, there's nothing that exists at all. Or, you know, whatever wrong views we have, this third one celebrates it and says, those are the best views to have. Okay, so that one's double confusion. Then the fourth one is the view of rules and practices. So this one also is an afflictive intelligence that believes purification of mental defilements occurs by engaging in ascetic practices, inferior codes of ethical conduct, and mistaken practices that are inspired by wrong views. It is the basis for wasting time on incorrect modes of practice that do not lead to our spiritual goals. So, this one holds wrong views about what to practice and abandon, and what is considered virtuous, what's considered non-virtuous. Okay, so this one, you know how there's this one guy who encourages everybody to walk across lighted coals? Yeah, so it's supposed to be, you know, advance you spiritually or something. So that kind of view. In ancient India, it seems like there was one school that believed if you jumped on a trident and it came out, the middle spoke came out the middle of your head, then you attained liberation. Or, the one that believes in animal sacrifice. Yeah, it's the one that believes that killing infidels leads you to a heavenly rebirth. It's the one, you know, that believes we have the one right view and we have to convert everybody to our view. Okay. Or the view that says, well, you know, killing can be good in certain circumstances. Yeah. Okay, then the fifth of the afflictive views is wrong views. So it's an afflictive intelligence that denies the existence of something that in fact exists. For example, karma and its effects, past and future lives, and the three jewels. Okay, so it believes, it denies the existence of something that in fact exists. It can also believe in something that doesn't exist. Usually it emphasizes the denial of things that do exist. Okay, but it could spill over into believing there's a divine creator or a primal substance, you know, that, remember, our mystical primal substance out of which everything appears. Okay, so it functions to prevent us from engaging in virtue and to lead us to create non-virtue. Yeah, so these, they're, even though they're just views, our views can be the source of so much trouble in our lives. Because when we have wrong views about what to practice and what to abandon, what leads to happiness, what leads to suffering, what's virtue and what's non-virtue, when we have wrong views about that, then we give ourselves permission to do all sorts of things. Yeah, because we find a way to rationalize and justify them that makes sense according to our views. Okay, so it's quite dangerous having wrong views. Okay, so we're still studying the mind. Yeah, we talked about primary minds that saw the general kinds of qualities of the object. And now we're into mental factors. We talked about the five omnipresent minds. We talked about the five object ascertaining minds. We talked about the 11 virtuous mental factors and the six root afflictions. And now the 20 auxiliary afflictions. Okay. So the 20 auxiliary afflictions are branches of the root afflictions and similarly disturb the mind. These will be explained in more depth in the next volume of the Library of Wisdom and Compassion, which is called Samsara, Nirvana, and Buddha Nature, and is coming out in
January.
Yes! You remember something from the teachings. So for now, suffice it to list these 20 auxiliary afflictions. Wrath, resentment, spite, jealousy, cruelty, miserliness, haughtiness, restlessness, concealment, lethargy, laziness, lack of faith, forgetfulness, non-introspective awareness, pretension, deceit, lack of integrity, inconsideration for others, heedlessness, and distraction. Aren't you happy that we're not reading the definitions of those tonight? It's horrific enough just reading the list, isn't it? And to know that we have all of them. Yeah, unless maybe you don't have, you're missing a few here and there. Yeah, no, we have each one. Now the four variable mental factors. Whew, let's get away from this afflictive stuff. Well, we should get away from the afflictive stuff and abandon them, okay? So the four variable mental factors. In themselves, the four variable mental factors are neither virtuous nor non-virtuous, but become so in dependence on our motivation and the other mental factors that accompany that same mental state. Okay, so these are mental factors. They can be virtuous, non-virtuous, depending on other things that are going on. Okay, so first one, sleep.
Virtuous.
Okay. Which wrong view is that one? Okay. So sleep makes the mind unclear, gathers the sense consciousnesses inward, and renders the mind incapable of apprehending the body. Sleeping out of attachment and laziness is destructive, so non-virtuous. Sleeping because the body is tired is neutral, and sleeping with the intention to resume our compassionate activities after resting is virtuous. So that's why they say before you go to sleep, try and, you know, say, I'm going to sleep, to dress my body so I can get up and continue cultivating the path. Then regret is the next one that, you know, can go either way. So it regards an appropriate or an inappropriate action that we have performed of our own accord or under pressure as something we do not wish to repeat. Regretting negativities is virtuous, but regretting our constructive actions is non-virtuous. Okay, so, you know, if it looks at an inappropriate action, we told somebody off, we, you know, stole something from them, and we regret that, that kind of regret is virtuous. And that regret, we need to do the purification practice, the four opponent powers. The other kind of regret, the destructive kind, is when we've done something virtuous and then we regret it. Oh, I gave that donation to that charity. Why did I do that? Now I don't have enough money to go buy this object that I want. Okay? So we regret our virtue. So that's really bad news. Okay. Why did I go to this retreat at Srivasti Abbey? I could have spent, you know, the week on a beach in Hawaii. Okay, so that destroys our virtue. Okay, then the third one is investigation. It's sometimes called course engagement, but course engagement doesn't tell us much, does it? So it arises depending on intention or wisdom and examines an object in general. And so it looks at the general characteristics. It doesn't do an in-depth analysis, but just looking at the object in general. So investigating the meaning of impermanence is virtuous, whereas investigating someone's fault with the intention to criticize them is non-virtuous. Okay, yeah, so we can investigate people's faults pretty well, huh? Yeah. Okay, then analysis, yeah, again, rises in dependence on intention or wisdom, but this one analyzes the object in detail. Okay, so analyzing the nature of reality with the motivation of bodhicitta is virtuous. But analyzing how to make more effective weapons with the intention to kill is destructive. Okay? So we have to see, you know, what we're analyzing and why. While there is much that can be said about each of these mental factors, the brief descriptions above give an idea of how our mind operates and the various kinds of thoughts, attitudes, and emotions, and views that arise in it at different times. Such a list of views, emotions, and attitudes provides a structure that helps us to get to know ourselves. We become more aware of our mental states by naming our thoughts and emotions. While meditating or going about our daily activities, it is helpful to practice identifying various mental factors and discerning whether they are conducive to happiness and constructive action or detrimental to them. When an affliction manifests in our mind, we must identify the mental factors that are opposed to it and then activate them. Okay? So you know, the reason for going through all these mental factors is because it really does give us a schema to look at our own mind and see the kinds of thoughts and emotions and views and so forth that we have. So it gives us a way to learn to identify what's going on. And some people, you know, sometimes we take it for granted that people can identify what they're feeling or what they're thinking. But, you know, many people have grown up in homes where they never learned the words to identify their emotions, or they never saw their parents speaking. And, you know, they don't have that role model of the parents identifying types of views or emotions. And so people don't, you know, they're feeling perturbed inside, but you say, what's wrong? And they don't know what to say because they never learned that. Yeah. So this listing these things in this way and giving the definitions is very helpful, even if we think we know how to label our emotions and thoughts and so on. Because then we look and we say, okay, well, what is really going on? And does it match this definition? Oh, it matches that. Oh, now I know what I'm feeling. Now I know what this view is. Okay? So it's very helpful for understanding the mind and how it works, and for assessing what parts of ourself we need to apply antidotes to because they're non-virtuous, and what qualities in ourselves that we really want to enhance because they're very conducive for our own and others' happiness. Okay, now there's the reflection. More material for breakfast and lunch and medicine meal tomorrow. Okay, so one, read the description of each mental factor, contemplate its meaning, and try to identify it in your own experience. Okay. Two, look especially at the 11 virtuous mental factors and the 6 root afflictions. Give examples, specific examples from your life of when you have experienced each of these mental states. You know, like that time when somebody cut me off on the highway and I sped up to overtake them, you know, there was anger in my mind. You know, specific things. Okay, then 3, outline both the external events and the internal causes, such as thoughts, moods, and so forth, that make each of these virtuous and non-virtuous mental factors arise. So what other events in your environment are triggers for both the virtuous and non-virtuous mental factors? And what other kinds of thoughts and views are going on in you that can trigger them? Okay, so this kind of reflection, if we really do it seriously over time, it really pays off. Yeah. And then 4, what effects do, somebody make note of that so we can change it when it's reprinted. What effects do each mental factor, now, each mental factor does have. What effects? No, does each mental factor. It's correct. Yeah. What effects does each mental factor have on your life, your spiritual practice, and your progress on the path to awakening? Okay, so looking at that as well. Okay, so we arrived at a good place to stop. So please write this in your notes because next year, for sure, I won't remember. So it's page 69, conceptual and non-conceptual consciousnesses. That's where we'll start. And then we'll finish that chapter quickly next year and then go into the chapters about the student-teacher relationship.
So someone says, is the deflated sense of self considered arrogance because the self is the center?
Because the self isn't...
Is the center?
Yeah, because we're overemphasizing the importance of the self and making the self into something it isn't. We're making the self into a, you know, I'm better than everybody else.
Deflated.
Deflated. Yeah, because again, it's if I can't be the best one, I'm going to be the worst one. But somehow, I stand out.
What makes dream objects considered to be form?
What makes what?
Dream objects to be considered form?
Dream objects to be considered form. They're forms for mental consciousness. So it's probably because they appear with colors, they appear to have sounds and so on. Yeah. So probably because of that, but they can't be actual forms because they're dream ones. Yeah, that's probably why.
When I look at the definitions of appreciation and mindfulness, they seem really similar, and I'm not quite grasping the difference between them.
Between appreciation and mindfulness? Mm-hmm. Appreciation is belief. You know, you're interested in something. Mindfulness is used when you're developing concentration and wisdom, and it focuses on the object. Okay? So mindfulness is you know, you're really focusing on something to, you know, to increase your concentration, to understand it better. Appreciation or belief is... you know, you believe in something, you appreciate it, you're interested in it. Okay.